My ambition after that trip to the Highlands was simply to see if Tasmania could make a really good single malt whisky.
We don't expect everyone to like these wines, so yes, there's some risk.
Drink more sherry, because that's when you can really educate yourself on what happens in maturation.
The thing is with Australian natives, you put them in a gin, the aftertaste invariably is just bitter and unpalatable.
I think the Irish whisky landscape is going to be wildly different over the next 5 years.
This is the Drinks Adventures podcast. I'm James Atkinson, and this is the show where I speak to some of the world's most exciting producers of beer, wine and spirits, and uncover trends and issues in the drinks industry today.
Maximilian Riedel is the 11th generation CEO of Austrian glassware company, Riedel. The company was founded in 1756, and according to Maximilian, it is currently facing some of the biggest challenges in its 267-year history. There's been the COVID pandemic, obviously, but more recently, the war in Ukraine, which is hugely concerning for an energy-intensive manufacturing business such as Riedel, given its reliance on Russian gas. In spite of these headwinds, though, Riedel recorded its most successful year of sales ever in 2022, and Australia was one of the top-performing markets. With Maximilian at the helm over the last decade, Riedel has continued its innovations with glassware for specific grape varieties and occasions, and trending drinks categories like Japanese sake. Its new range, Riedel Veloce, has been made using a specially developed machine to create glassware that looks and feels as though it was made by hand by a master glassmaker. I sat down with Maximilian while he was in Sydney recently for his first visit in many years. Maximilian Riedel, thanks so much for joining us on the Drinks Adventures podcast.
Thank you, James, for having me.
I've just been doing some reading before this chat and seen that Riedel recorded its most successful year ever in 2022. What were the contributing factors to that?
Well, we came out of a situation, the whole world obviously was overwhelmed with the fact that we all were either locked at home, couldn't travel, and people refurbished, I believe, their houses. People once again fell in love with the good stuff, wine. And we had the great benefit of people enjoying good wine in best glasses during that time. So it's the consumer actually that pushed us above and beyond. Consumers really love wine, and not only wine, also other beverages. And they identified Riedel as the perfect glass to help them go through that difficult time.
So, you know, wine appreciation has really grown worldwide in recent years, and Riedel has grown along with that. And the pandemic was essentially, you know, it kind of really helped accelerate some of those trends that we're already seeing in consumption.
This is absolutely correct. I mean, if you talk to the champagne houses with whom I'm very much connected, they tell you that they actually were sold out for a long period of time. It was not possible in certain countries to get champagne. My largest export market is the United States. They had a champagne drought for about 6 months. The demand was enormous, and people just couldn't keep up with the high demands. On top of that, globally, we had some challenges in logistics. So not only were we short on product, but also the logistics didn't help. So we were just in the midst of it. And of course, we are being in business for more than 260 years, catering to the world of wine lovers and spirits lovers. Also, we were overwhelmed. And in our country, the factories were shut down for a certain period of time due to Corona and all the issues that came with it. So of course, this kind of month of production, they were missing and they are still missing up to date.
What about Australia specifically? Because I understand that, you know, Riedel's strongest growth globally has been in the Australian market.
Well, it's one of them. Australia is a market that we cater to for a very long time. We have a subsidiary here in Australia with a very successful team in place. And over the last, I would say, 20 years, Australia was year over year growing in terms of business, in terms of sales. It's not easy anymore to find new channels. I think we're covering most of the channels. And we are happy about the demand in our brand. So I think that the local team does a fantastic job in promoting it. We are partners with most of the wine groups, of the wine producers. And my people travel the country to support wherever we can.
How competitive is the market for fine glassware? You know, when you just mentioned champagne, for example, and when you mentioned champagne, I can think of quite a lot of really high-end champagne brands. But with glassware, it seems to me that there aren't so many players. But is that my perception of the Australian market, or how competitive is it generally?
You're absolutely right. I would say since the crisis that we faced in 2008 globally, a lot of our smaller competitors went out of business, especially from Eastern Europe. Eastern Europe always had the benefit of cheap labor. And since the European Union grew, income somewhat leveled off all over Europe. So this advantage was gone. And many of the Czech, Slovakian companies went out of business. So, which is not good news. You would think that's great news for me, but it is quantities that we cannot come up with and supply. And also during the pandemic, we saw that the demand for fine glassware, in particular for handmade glassware, outgrew the capacities of production. And it's such a difficult environment, glass production and whatever comes with it, that you won't find any newcomers. So established brands or small brands that source product, they're popping up here and there. But I think where we stand right now is the maximum that we could get in terms of production output.
The maximum that your business can, or?
The global glass industry.
Right, okay, just because of materials and?
Not so much the materials, just because of lack of producers.
Right, okay.
Manufacturers. So
lots of opportunity out there in the market for
I would say so. I mean, if you're in the glass business, you should have lots of opportunities.
Yeah.
No matter at what price level, high end, but also entry level, the demand is there, but there's a lack of production.
And what are the barriers to entry? You know, why haven't we seen more players coming into the market over the last decade?
Yeah, we're talking about little margin.
Yeah.
That's the
hard to get started and established.
Exactly. The disadvantage is that people have lost this kind of feeling for glass in general. Glass seems to be a cheap product. It never was like this. It was always reserved for royal families and churches in the past centuries. But since we have a global retail player called IKEA, who started to sell off glasses at a very inexpensive
price. I actually noticed that I'm drinking out of an IKEA tumbler.
People don't go to IKEA to buy glass. They go there to buy furniture, but they see inexpensive glass and they take along a pack. And this really killed the glass industry.
And, you know, what has that meant for your business, though? It hasn't seemed to have a negative impact on Riedel so much.
This is true because we focus exclusive on wine and wine glass. And here there are, believe it or not, in so many years of glass production, there's a 4,000-year history of producing fine glass and products in glass, including glass jewelry. But there are trends, and the new trend is the thinner and the lighter, the better. And my grandfather started this in the 1950s, but the world wasn't ready for it because people said, we can't look at it before it breaks and it's too fragile. And now everybody wants it fragile and thin. I guess the reason is people have learned to handle thin, fragile glass. Most people put it in a dishwasher. That's also what I would recommend for people to do with washing your glasses. So the trends are there, and there are very few companies that actually can produce quality glasses at that quality, at that lightness and finesse.
Talk to me about sort of what have been some of the biggest, if you were to look over the last few decades at Riedel, what would be, you know, some of the most significant milestones at the company in terms of the products that you've brought to market that have really gotten traction and also helped the company on its growth trajectory?
So in 1973, Professor Klaus Riedel, my grandfather, he introduced the very first gourmet glass line, a wine-specific glass or stemware that wasn't there before. You go to antique stores, you read all the history books about wine and wine glasses. He really set the milestone. He created an entire industry because all our competitors, all they do is follow his lead. So he was the first to come up with a Burgundy glass, with a Bordeaux glass. And then it took a generation, like my father, who introduced grape varietal-specific glasses. And George Riedel, my father, was also the man who went from handmade to machine production. He was the man who really was able to work with people. Riedel was not then in machine production at all. All we produced was mouth-blown handmade. But he found sources that were able to produce and introduce with us the first machine-made stemmed wine glasses. And these glasses, the first collection of Riedel in general was called Sommelier. The first machine glass collection was called Vinum. And this is still our number one seller here in Australia, believe it or not, after so many years. Vinum was introduced in 1986. And then I came and I lived in New York in those days. I lived in America for about 14 years. And I saw that everything went casual, including wine consumption went casual. So yeah, when you want to be casual, you had to also somehow, it had to impact the way we drank wine from stemmed glasses, and we went stemless. So I introduced Riedel O, which is nowadays still one of our best seller, but it also is the most copied glass in the glass industry. Every of my competitor came forward with a wine tumbler. So this was my brainchild. And now we are at a level where people can't identify anymore the difference between a handmade and a machine-made glass, because we invest so much in technology, in our own factories, in our own machines that we self-develop, to come forward with glasses that look and feel and perform like handmade glasses. And we have to do that because nobody wants to work in a factory anymore. So I can't find glassmakers anymore. And that's not only my issue, that's the whole glass world's issue, that the young generation doesn't want to work in a factory environment. People are getting paid very well. And it's a different factory environment than 30, 40 years ago. It's a very safe environment. But ask the next generation who's studying right now if they want to work in a factory. It's like downgrading people, which is absolutely not the fact. For me, our glassmakers, they are artisans. They're the most skilled people I know. And it's a dying breed. So we have to go to the machine. And we're investing and we're coming up with great products.
Yeah, so maybe we can talk about that. This is the new Veloce, is it Veloce range?
Yes, Riedel Veloce.
That's right. So that hit the market just recently.
In June of 2022, so very recent. It's about a half a year on the market. And Veloce is Italian for speed. And I put it under the name because there is nobody in the field that looks at the glass, touches, feels the glass, the balance, and could say, that's machine made. That's exactly, that was my goal. It's the thinnest, tallest, best performing machine made glass on the market. Some of the aspects in terms of production are world records. So I'm very, very excited about it as a glassmaker. I'm excited about it as a wine lover, because the way how it shows wines is new. It's a different level. So we're very proud about it. And there's such a demand for it that currently in some markets it's sold out. We can't keep up with production, and I'm just knocking on wood. I hope it continues like that. But the reason is not only because we make good glasses, it's because the demand for wine is there. Wine is booming. We are producing nowadays better quality wines than ever before. Weather conditions are helping us globally. So I think we're off to a good start.
The Japanese sake glassware that you developed, how well was that embraced by the industry? Have there been particular producers that have been using that to showcase their sake, or is there going to always be a real resistance to kind of moving away from the traditional serving?
Yeah, I was the first glassmaker in the world to come up with a glass for sake, which we developed with the sake brewers, which was one of the most challenging jobs we had to do, because the first thing we went up against was tradition. Some sake producers are in the 50th generation, jaw-dropping. I'm in the 11th generation, and everybody thinks, wow, that's an old family. But when you go to Japan, that's not an old family whatsoever. So in terms of sake, we saw a big trend globally 5 to 10 years ago. It was there to stay. And I traveled first to Japan to learn more about it in the late 1990s, and my father prior. So it's a beverage that that we know since a very long time. We have studied it, the way how it's being produced, the different stylistics, Jumai Daiginjo, Kojo, and different styles. And it was actually a few brewers who approached us and said, there must be above and beyond. We cannot stick to the traditional cups. And the glass that we have developed, different styles of glass, due to the different stylistics of sake. They didn't happen overnight. It took us 25 years to enter this small clique, the small group of sake producers, to connect with them. And it started with a glass of wine. We wanted to show them how our glasses can support wine culture, how our glasses can support grape varieties. Then, of course, spirits. We have specific glasses for different spirits at Riedel. That's a portfolio that we have since many, many years, but very few people know about it. So that was the next level, is the spirit culture. And in those days, we saw sake as a spirit. Now we call it rice wine. But when we started the whole concept, we saw it as a spirit. It was at 15% alcohol. Wine in those days was 11, 12 to 13. Now wine is above and beyond 15%. So we must call it actually rice wine. We cannot call it spirit anymore. So we learned so much. They learned a lot from us. And yes, there were a lot of producers that were with us and a lot of them against us originally. But I'm happy that we succeeded. And you can tell that we succeeded because also all over the world, people who are keen about sake, they serve sake and order sake now in a wine glass because the wine glass itself can do so much better than the traditional cups. Sake can smell good. High-grade sake, where we polish the rice corn like a Jumai Daiginjo, it has very floral notes to it versus very standard basic sake, which can have an off smell. So I understand why in certain situations the little cup does its job, but when you really want to learn and talk about sake, you should serve it in a wine glass.
Now, this is, I believe, in 2023, it's 10 years that you've been in the CEO position.
I think I stopped counting.
Oh, you stopped counting?
But yes.
You know, what do you think have been, you touched on the stemless launch, for example, but what have been the other biggest sort of achievements that you think that you've made during that time?
The decanters, we shouldn't forget. It's the art of decanting wine is my slogan, which became very popular because of my social media channel. I have my own channel called Maxi Riedel, which has a great following ship. I think it's one of the largest in the wine industry right now. And this is also the way how I speak directly to the customer, B2B, but also B2C. I think we're the only glass company in the world who has set the benchmark in terms of communication. I also like advertising, to be honest with you. Right now, we have three billboards at Times Square in New York because by just producing quality and not communicating it, you don't get far. As an entrepreneur, you need to produce it. I'm traveling the world to introduce it to your senses. I'm here in Sydney to conduct two Riedel Glass workshops where I will guide people and their senses through the fascinating world of grape varietal-specific glasses. And then, of course, everything about social media. I mean, this is the way how people nowadays get their information, good or bad. But I was one of the very first to get into this in our industry.
What made you see that opportunity, you know? And it is very unique, I think, yeah, as a CEO to be so hands-on. You know, most companies would sort of have someone else who does that for them and you're the face. Yeah, it's authenticity.
Exactly. So people say, how can you be the CEO? How can you be the creative mind? And how can you do everything on social media? Well, that's what I do. I don't think many others do it the same way. Maybe they can't do it this way, but that's what drives me. My job comes first. I'm lucky to love what I'm doing. And I was introduced to social media when I was living and working in America. There's a very famous guy in the wine industry called Gary Vanderchuk. Gary and I, we grew up together in the sense his father had a wine and liquor store in New Jersey. I lived in New Jersey. It was my go-to place. And Gary was a sales guy there in his father's wine store. And so we liked each other. We talked a lot. And one day he called me and says, Max, I need to talk to you. You need to get on board with this. And I said, what is it? It's called Facebook. And I said, what is Facebook? So he introduced it to me. Originally, everybody used Facebook for a different reason. It was the best dating site, I would say. But soon I realized it was great for business. Then Twitter came on board, and then, of course, Instagram came on board. But he was the man introducing it to me, telling me about the advantages, and since I'm hooked.
You know, is it Instagram that's kind of been the most important channel for you being, you know, it's obviously glassware is a beautiful thing, your decanters are beautiful, and it works particularly well on that platform, I would assume.
Well, as an entrepreneur, we always need to also consider return on investment. And Riedel always invested in print publications, print media. During Corona, I was able to utilize one of the oldest communication tools, which is TV. Interesting enough, certain countries in Europe, I took advantage. The prices came down. I jumped on it. Gave me great exposure. But when we were in print, like the New York Times was always very expensive, I remember. It was like 15,000 to 30,000 euros or then dollars for a quarter of a page. And it made me very proud. But I never knew if people actually saw it, if they reacted to it. And on social media, I know exactly how many hits, clicks, likes, or buying through that little post that we put out there. So it allows me much more to track the success. And the success was immediate. So that's what we are focusing on right now.
And how do you balance, you know, the time that you devote to social media with your managerial responsibilities? Because I imagine that it could be a full-time job just doing the social media.
Absolutely.
If you wanted it to be.
People earn money with it. I don't.
Yes.
I don't. But, you know, when you travel as much as I do, you have a lot of downtime going to the airport, sitting at the airport, on the flight. I'm using this. I'm not lazy. I'm not getting myself. I don't have so many hobbies. For me, my job is my hobby. It's linked to.
I've been reading about your interest in cars, though.
But I can't travel with them, you know.
No. Yeah.
When traveling in a car, you shouldn't be on social media, everybody out there. Good? So that's dangerous. Don't do it. So, of course, I have my little things that I value, like my family. That's number one before everything else. But when I travel, and I travel a lot, 200 days out of the year, the downtime I use for social media.
I believe that the war in Ukraine has had a very significant impact on your business. How are things tracking? Tell us about some of those issues and how things are tracking currently.
So first of all, the war started nearly a year ago. So we're a year into it. Nobody would have ever believed as a European that we would have a war in the heart of Europe. And if you look where the Ukraine is located, it is truly the heart of Europe. We have so many neighboring countries which are part of the European Union, shocking to all of us. Very sad. Also, I have a lot of friends in the Ukraine. We have a very developed business in the Ukraine, as I have in Russia. Over the last 10, 15 years, the businesses in both countries became very successful. So what do you do? That's a very difficult question that all of us are confronted with. Of course, we supported our Ukrainian partners, which we continue to do wherever we can. Believe it or not, there is business right now going on in the Ukraine, which was surprising to all of us, that my distributors actually want product, that they sell product. Big surprise. A big part of my raw materials come from the Ukraine. So that's an issue for me as a manufacturer. But the biggest issue, of course, is energy. We Europeans, like Austria, Germany, these are the two countries where I produce, where I manufacture my product, we were 100% dependent on Russian gas. And the basic material number one is energy. I need so much energy to melt, to blow, to manufacture a wine glass that we are 100% dependent. So if there would have been ever a shutdown of gas in Europe, we would have been out of business. It's that brutal because the aftermath is the problem. If you can't fire it, we are melting glass in big vats and in different formats, that if the glass would become hard, it would dry out and we would have to rebuild the whole factories. So there would be no production for approximately a year. So we continue to be worried. The governments and politics didn't help. They put out panics. I'm very upset with the German government about this because all of Europe looks what the German government does.
And they were talking about rationing of
exactly.
gas, is that correct?
And turning it off and making sure that we go through the winter as individuals without any difficulty. And if there are challenges, then it's the industry that has to take it. So there were, for about 3 months, crazy thoughts, crazy preparations. Europe was in despair. We didn't know what to do. Thank God that leveled off, that stopped. It has become calmer. The governments found immediate alternative sources for gas. So nobody really talks about it anymore, to our surprise. But everybody did a panic purchase of futures, including us. And that's why we had to increase our prices last year 2 times already. And we don't know where and if we can keep the prices at par. for the next 12 months to come. Our labor cost has doubled in percent, so double digit in increase in labor cost, in energy, in raw materials. And on top of all of that, the problems with the logistics. And if you listen to Amazon right now, biggest retailer in the world, their business declined online for my brand, for most other brands right now, is declining double digits. And for me, the biggest challenge is and remains logistics. How do I get my products on containers to Australia? And the cost for container shipments is above and beyond. We would have never considered this additional cost. So there are, as an entrepreneur, there are so many new challenges that we're facing besides production, besides interest in my brand. It's just being an entrepreneur, not only in my field, I think is very challenging and has been very challenging for the past 3 years.
11th generation business, though, obviously would have been through many challenges over the years. So we look at, you know, global conflicts and those types of things. But from speaking to you, you know, to your father and your grandfather before him, you know, does your father sort of look at the current conditions that you're operating in and sort of say, gee, we didn't, you know, I didn't have anything to, like that to deal with when I was at the helm?
So my father is a vintage 1949. Yeah. So he was born after World War II, but he grew up during the rebuild period in Europe, in a country that was under a lot of pressure, as you can imagine. Austria, Germany was the most disliked nations in the world for a long period of time. So they had their challenges. But if you ask him now, he would say that during Corona, these were the biggest challenges that he ever faced in his life. I mean, there were the old oil crisis, there were the bank crisis. Again, we didn't go through a war the last two generations, so we cannot speak for that. I would say the last 10 to 20 years have been very challenging for all of us around the world.
And yet you're still growing.
We're growing because we set the tracks. We're growing because we're adamant, we're focused, we're determined, and every money that we earn, we reinvest in technology, in great people, educated people. You can't do your business by yourself. You're surrounding yourself with professionals. And we have been very lucky with our picks and partners. For example, here in Australia, we have a long-standing partner that does for us the distribution negotiations for the on-premise. We couldn't do it without them. So I think we are set in a very good way. And if there are no further crises, I should be able to hand it over to the 12th generation.
Do you feel a big responsibility, you know, being the 11th generation family owner? It's a lot of responsibility on your shoulders to stay family owned, I guess.
Exactly. So to stay family owned when we have successful business is not the trouble. If you become greedy and you want more, and yes, you can only achieve by selling, that's one way to do it. Thinking about the Mondavi family in the wine industry. They were the first big family that sold off everything. And now if you ask the young Mondavi family members, would you do it again? And they all would deny it. They would never do it again because you have one name, one life. And if you build something, I think you should treasure it. And my biggest challenge is to make it interesting for the next generation. I would fail if I would not be able to bring in the 12th generation. So I have to build it further, but then I have to pass it on to the next generation. And when this is done, I did my job.
And you said before that for the younger generation that the craftsmanship of glass is not necessarily an alluring career. So is that what you mean by making it interesting for them as well?
No, because I don't think that neither my daughter nor my son will be standing in a factory and blowing glass. But I will hand over to them the opportunity for them to surround themselves with great glassmakers if they're still around. But at the same time, we will hand them the most modern and advanced glass producing factory in the world. And then it's up to them to see how far they can take it. I don't know if the family wants to only stick to glass production. Maybe there are some new materials that could be of interest. Maybe wine glasses is not the future. Maybe some other products in glass could be the future. But this is something I leave up to them. I'm doing right now what I'm doing, and I think we're doing it very successful. There's still plenty of room for us to grow. There are new trends in the industry. There are new trends in the wine industry that are very much of interest. I mean, you can't compare wines from now to wines that were made in the 70s and 80s. They have evolved To me, they have become better wines. The whole world nowadays can produce wine. I've had wine from Sweden. I've had wine from Norway. Is it as good? Definitely not. Does it have potential? Well, with global warming, for sure. Why is the whole world looking at Southern England for sparkling wines? Why is the world looking at Tasmania for sparkling wines? Champagne, all the big producers are venturing off. They're looking for new soil, for new developments because of the challenges that they face in the Champagne. It's getting warmer and warmer. Champagne is considering to produce still wines in future. Very interesting. So I'm surrounded by all these great minds. I hear this, of course. I don't read this. I get it directly from the wine industry. So there are a lot of great opportunities, I would say. It's never going to get boring in the industry of fine wine.
Well, thanks very much for taking the time to have a chat with us on the Drinks Adventures podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.